and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, the history of public art in Anchorage and Alaska. Hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society at the Anchorage Museum on September 15th, hear from Jocelyn Young, Curator of Public Art for the Municipality of Anchorage, coming up next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans, after the news. KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans. This week's program on the history of public art in Anchorage and Alaska was recorded at a public lecture hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society at the Anchorage Museum on September 15th. If you have a computer nearby, we encourage you to follow along with the photo slideshow of public art in our community posted on KSKA's website, alaskapublic.org.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our first of programs this year involving Cook Inlet Historical Society and our annual programming. We have hot off the press the program that we plan for the upcoming year, and we're going to be talking about the history of art, which is a pretty unusual topic for Cook Inlet Historical Society, but we're doing it as a result of the plans by the Anchorage Museum next year to present a True North exhibit, an Art in Alaska exhibit, featuring many pieces of work not only from the Anchorage Museum but also from throughout the state. And so what we've decided this year is to develop a program about art. And I'd like to commend to you our brochure, which you'll find out front. In addition, for those of you who are members of either Cook Inlet Historical Society or the museum, you receive the Anchorage Museum Today program. And I hope you all notice that for the first time, the museum has actually put the Cook Inlet Historical Society program in the museum program. So you have it in two places, so I'm sure one will be on the refrigerator side of your refrigerator and the other will be on the freezer side of your refrigerator, so you remember to come to our meetings. And we look forward to seeing you back in the future. I'll talk a little about our next program at the end of our lecture this evening. Okay, the main event tonight is Jocelyn Young. She's the Curator of Public Art and Works for the Public Works Department of the Municipality of Anchorage. As the curator of the 1% for Art program, she oversees 441 works of art, probably the way that most of us come in contact with art here in Anchorage. And these are all public buildings, parks, and schools throughout the community. Each year, the program adds about 8 to 15 works of art to the public art collection. My wife, who used to be a member of, or used to be the principal of Huffman Elementary School, worked with Jocelyn, and I won't say how many years ago, when they expanded Huffman Elementary School, just an example of the many different pieces of work that have come into the public art collection. Jocelyn works with over 110 volunteers who donate over 2,000 hours annually. She has a degree in communications from the University of Utah. Prior to working with the municipality, she was the director of the Arts and Education Program for the Alaska State Council on the Arts for 15 years, where she worked extensively with artists and served on many regional and national projects and local panels. Please welcome Jocelyn Young.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, and thank you to the Cook Inlet Historical Society for inviting me to come and talk about public art. It's certainly an honor. I appreciate everything Cook Inlet Historical Society has done for art in our community and their support of the museum, which has been extensive. Well, we'll jump right into it. We kind of picked a topic to talk about, the history of public art in Anchorage and Alaska, and I realized that there isn't a lot written on some of this material, so I had to call some old sources and do some interesting research. So this has been a pretty fun project for me to work on, and I'll jump right into it. Public art in the United States began with battle monuments and statues of heroes on horseback, following a long tradition of European tradition. And when I was doing my research on this, what was most interesting was there's a big debate about whether one horse's foot is up, whether the horse has 1 foot up or 2 feet up or it's rearing up, and what that means, whether the person died in battle or was wounded in battle. And then you read through all of these different urban legends and you realize they are urban legends that really probably didn't mean anything. So, I mean, I found some interesting things too. I just always thought these guys on horseback were just, you know, different people from different battles, but there are some things that are interesting about them. These old statues in Europe and in America are over 100, 200 years old, or in Europe, of course, over 200 years old, and they're really starting to see some pretty serious decline with acid rain, and there's a big movement afoot to really try and conserve these older pieces. There are also, in the 1930s then, with the Works Progress Administration, WPA, and the New Deal stimulated another surge in the production of public art as a means of employment for many artists and companies put out of work by the Great Depression. There's a large mural in the old Federal Building downtown by Arthur Carrick, and Wrangell has this mural by Austin Mecklen and Marianne Apple titled Old Town in Alaska. And what was interesting about this is that a lot of people thought that these older pieces in these post offices were WPA projects, and it turns out they were not. There was a section in the post office called the Section. It was the Section of Fine Arts, and they would do artwork for all their new post office buildings. And we always think of them a little bit as WPA projects, and they're really post office projects. There is some public art in our communities, and a lot of it consisted of civic statues and sculptures that were selected by the donor for a specific event or recognition. And I think this piece was commissioned, it says on the plaque, it was commissioned by the Mutual of New York for the anniversary of Seward's purchase of Alaska, but I think that's what it was for. And it was done by a local artist, Jerry Conaway. And then we have our famous Captain Cook, and he was donated by BP in 1976 in honor of the nation's bicentennial. And I don't know how many of you remember Nimbus. These are all pieces that predated our state and our local 1% for art. So these are pieces that, this is generally how artwork came to being located in many communities in the state of Alaska. So we have Nimbus now. Nimbus was moved. It's now on the state of Alaska, the museum down in Juneau. Then we have this piece by Keith Apple. It's called Aurora. It was in 1981, and it was just the beginning of the state public art program, and it was commissioned by the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce. In 1975, the state of Alaska made a pioneering move to be one of the only 10 states that required public art to be installed in state buildings and state-funded projects. Roy Helms was the director of the State Arts Council, and he knew Hawaii, I think maybe Washington, had passed a law, and he sold the council on it, and it was passed. Connie Boochiever was the chair at that time of the council at that time, and she had quite a bit of pull down in the state legislature, so she made it happen. And since then, we have pieces in urban areas at the Nesbitt Courthouse, and this is a very early piece of work, 1983, Alex Combs' piece. And then we have more contemporary pieces at the Anchorage Airport. And one of the very first Alaska Native art collections, and this is a museum-quality collection that was collected by Susie Fair. And this was one of the very early 1% for art pieces where we collected Alaska Native art from all over the state, and we put them in cases so that people at the Anchorage Airport could enjoy them and see what a rich and indigenous local culture and artistic heritage we had. This is a tradition that was carried on. These are the cases we did out at the Elmendorf Airport or Elmendorf Hospital. And then the 1% for Art program was also very active out in rural Alaska. So these are pieces. This is a piece by Jim Schoper. This is another piece out there in Chifornik. And I think it's very interesting to see what the rural Alaskan communities have done with public art also. In 1978, the city of Anchorage decided, with the instigation and support from the Urban Design Commission, and that was led by Pam Coates, we decided to follow the state's lead. And I think that was partly because we were getting ready to build a whole bunch of Project 80s buildings, and we thought, well, we're going to be using state money for these buildings. We're going to be building and putting a lot of artwork, and we want to control that, the process of how that's done. I think that was part of the impetus for that. So the program requires 1% of the construction budget for all public buildings built in the municipality of Anchorage, and that includes parks, not trails, but it does include parking lots, doesn't include major maintenance or anything like that. So these are some of our Project 80s pieces, and we learned a lot through these Project 80s pieces. The Carl Nesjar Fountain is currently being maintained by AWWU volunteers, which is great because, as you know, water in Anchorage, summer and winter, has been sort of interesting process we've learned about. And what we have learned is that the people who should be taking care of it are the people who know how to deal with water. So since 1981, the year that the first work of art was installed, we've spent $12.5 million on artwork for the commissioner purchase, and that's as the result of Alaska's program. Reflecting the direct tie to construction activity and state financial history, the peak year to date for installation of artwork was 1985, when 50 works of art were acquired at a total cost of $835,000. A quarter of the work in the whole 1% for Art program in Anchorage was acquired during Project 80s. So now that's one of the reasons why we're starting to see more and more pieces needing some kind of help. 33 years later, the collection has grown to over 440 pieces created by almost as many artists, of whom approximately two-thirds are Alaskan. The collection has large, high-profile pieces and smaller, more intimate pieces. Each project has a different personality, from Chugiak to Girdwood. More than 85 schools, including elementary, junior high, and high schools, also benefit from the program. And I have to apologize to artists that are here that don't have their artwork in my slide images. I know I always try to find out who's coming if I can to put their images in. And some of my images I still have in a slide format, so I haven't moved them into a digital format yet. Some of them are very contemporary. Some of them are more representational. Some of them have a narrative format. Buildings which don't have substantial public use and are located in remote areas are exempt from the public art ordinance in the Anchorage program. So how has the program impacted artists? I asked a few, and here are some of the responses I received. Susan Joy Scher, a ceramicist, performance artist, and bookmaker, said, "The 1% for Art program helped broaden the scope of my work by renewing my interest in ceramics. I drew on past experience from my education at the College of Ceramics at Alfred to create approximately 40 square feet of handmade tiles for murals for the South Anchorage High School. It put me on a path to further experimentation with clay and glazes, and I acquired skills in fitting, grouting, and frame design. I was asked to exhibit my tile work as part of the Masters of Mud at the Anchorage Museum and connected with the ceramic community. I later created a series of sculptural cast grout pieces with embedded objects." And Susan's also, as I mentioned, a bookmaker, and this is also a book about the history of the book and writing that she created for the library at South Anchorage High School. And it is under glass, and it's beautifully displayed. And it's fun when we do have an opportunity to do some of these smaller, more intimate pieces. I think they add a lot to the collection. I'm showing some of the artist's favorite pieces of their own and of other pieces as I talk about them. As with most artists, Susan has worked with architects, school administrators, and construction companies. She says it gave her experience in design, planning, budgeting, record keeping, working with committees and other artists, and executing work in conjunction with building schedules. This experience led her to her next public work. She competed and won a private commission to design and create the donor recognition wall for the New Providence Cancer Center. This in turn led to another private commission to make a tile backsplash for a private home. So all of these things added together all sort of end up being a steamrolling of a project where an artist gets their work out there, someone sees it. That's exactly what the kind of opportunity we are trying to make. Another long-term time Alaskan artist, Keith Apple, feels the public art program in Alaska has enabled him to do large-scale pieces that he would not have been able to produce to afford otherwise. Sculpture is so much more expensive produced than any other public artwork, and I don't think that the public has any real idea of what those costs are, nor do they understand the time constraints to producing large works of art. He feels the most important pieces he's produced all required a lot of personal sacrifice to make. The criteria he used to select these pieces is that they are defined by the real risks that were taken on their behalf and the total commitment and sustained enthusiasm that they still generate for him. And I just put this in because it's one of my favorite pieces of Keith's. He didn't mention it, but I thought, oh, I'm going to put that in. Barbara Yava and Andy Doust also believe that without the 1% for Art program, they would not have been able to dream the big dreams. It has allowed them to work in a grand scale, physically as well as budgetary. That is nearly non-existent in our community on a private scale. Public art pushes their current workload and scope to explore new realms and work on a different level. It also enables artists to work with other professionals in design and fabrication fields. It leads to other work, something that's always good for artists. Are artists doing projects for the 1% for Art program are interested in some of the following things, and I'm not mentioning all of them by any means. They really enjoy having the recognition of the creative value of their work. Putting artwork in a gallery for sale is scary, but it's only there for a short time and eventually you move on. All artists doing public artwork start with work in galleries and smaller pieces for sale. Most continue to have shows and exhibit their more personal work in museums and galleries. Putting your work out there for permanent display takes courage, creativity, and lots of self-confidence. Depending on whether people love or hate the piece, you're going to hear about it. You've spent months poring over plans and elevations, figuring out how to make it work, and when it's finally installed, it better be right. This is a new piece we dedicated last fall in Mountain View, and the people all standing around there are all the different peoples whose faces were cast and then installed on the wall here by these two artists. Scale and material appropriateness, fabrication, working with a variety of subcontractors, all throw wrenches into your perfect drawings and vision. Artists want recognition of the economic value of their work and their subcontractors. It's important to recognize that most artists work in their studios producing work for sale. And when producing a piece of public art, they need to work with other professionals and artists. It's not a solitary situation. When Sheila Wine worked on her recent installation, Big Game, at Diamond High School, she wanted to make sure people knew how much of her commission went to small businesses and artists and other people in the community. So here she is in the studio, and here's a couple of people helping her. And here is her installation process. And here is her list of all of the people, the individuals and major vendors They're all local businesses and local artists except for one person on that list. And I think that's who she bought her lighting from. I think she ordered her lighting from out of state. So all of those people benefited from her commission for that artwork. Artists want to educate the public about art and our world around us. They want people to stop and notice something different or striking that might be new or they might not have noticed before. They want to leave their mark. Some of the artists who created work in Anchorage have now moved out of state or passed away, leaving us with a legacy of work that helps us remember their importance and significance in the big picture. Today, most states across the United States have public art programs similar to the one here in Anchorage. Well, why is public art so important? Public art programs are designed to provide high-quality art in public places. Like Jim mentioned, it's often the one it's the one time many of us see art in our day-to-day lives is in a school or in a public building. And we want to make it accessible to all people and integrate it into their daily life, not just the people who happen to want to come to the museum to see artwork, which is also important, but we also want people to see things, artwork, in their day-to-day life. The visual arts stimulate creative thinking and problem solving as well as being pleasing to look at, adding value, giving us a sense of history in our city and state. In 1934, Edward Bruce, the head of the post office section of fine arts, and this said this on the slide that had the post office mural on it, a former lawyer, businessman, and artist, that section of fine arts, main function was to select art of high quality to decorate, is what they called it, buildings, if the funding was available. By providing decoration in public buildings, the art was made accessible to all. And that's what they wrote in 1934 about that post office program. At our recent dedication of Sheila Wine's Big Game pieces, Carol Como said, if she were a teacher, she would have her kids out there writing about these wonderful sculptures in our community. So they're also often a teaching tool. The goal is to thrill and inspire, and I always tell people there is something in the program for everyone. And if you might not happen to like one piece, you'll find another piece that you like a lot, I'm sure of it. So I hope I've given you something to think about the next time you see a piece of public art. And I thought it would be nice to end on the John Hoover piece who recently passed away a couple of weeks ago. He is one of the artists in the public art program who worked very small for many, many years. And when the program gave him the opportunity to work bigger, he went for it, and from then on, I think his work always remained quite a bit larger. He loved working in this large scale. It just was thrilling to him. So I'll end my program now, and if you have any questions that you want to ask me, you're welcome to, or I don't know how you want to do that, but I appreciate being invited, and thank you for your very welcome.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Jocelyn Young, curator of public art for the municipality of Anchorage. The Cook Inlet Historical Society hosted Jocelyn's public lecture on the history of public art and Alaska at the Anchorage Museum on September 15th. You can find a photo slideshow of the public art Jocelyn discussed on our website, alaskapublic.org. Following her talk, Jocelyn responded to questions from audience members. First, she was asked to comment on the role of committees in the art selection process.
Well, I didn't really talk about that very much, but every project that comes up in the public art program, every single time we have a construction project, there is a whole separate new committee that is formed that makes the decisions and selections for that artwork. There's always an artist on the committee. There's always an architect. There's always at least one person from that facility, either in charge of that facility or someone they designate. And there are always people from the community. Now in my program, I always try and get someone, if it's a school, I try and get someone who lives across the street. I figure if they're going to be looking at the artwork all the time, they need to maybe have a say about it. So so we do try and fill our committees with people who are both knowledgeable, but also people who are going to be seeing that work all the time. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't, to see committees function and talk about art and how they grow as they discuss the artwork. And sometimes they'll say, well, I would put that in my living room, but I wouldn't put that on the school wall. So it's interesting to see how committees grow and mesh together. And it's a good experience. And if any of you are interested, let me know, or call me at that number or my email, and let me know you're interesting, and I'll put you on a list. I try to put people on committees in close to their neighborhood so that you have a vested interest. Is that what you wanted to know, Andrea?
Yes.
Okay.
Next, another audience member asked, what has been your most controversial piece of art?
Oh, I didn't show the controversial pieces. Actually, I think the most controversial piece in the program were Donnie Varnell's totem poles for Ptarmigan Elementary School, because they're Japanese animation figures meshed with traditional Haida imagery. And there was one person on the school board who was very opposed to them and made a big fuss about it, because she felt that if they're going to put totem poles up in front of a school, they should be traditional. And so then I had the whole entire Southeast Alaska community of carvers and tradition bearers calling me, which was interesting because we're on Dena'ina land, so that was very interesting to me anyway, that we already have this departure. We were doing artwork from another, that was really representational from another part of the state. But I think I spent a whole month dealing with that issue and those. And it turned out that the person on the school board finally backed way down and apologized, and basically said that she realized that her son, who she hopes will someday become an artist and a carver, she hopes that he's not limited just by traditional designs. And she realized that by taking that stance, that wasn't going to free him up to be able to have personal freedom in his expression. So that was an interesting way it all evolved and ended. And I think that was actually even more controversial than our sitting man out here in front of the museum, Habitat. He's been pretty up and down. He's gotten a lot of play, but you know, more and more people are talking about seeing him more often, liking him more, getting used to him being there, and it'll be interesting to see how his legacy evolves.
The next hand that extended from the audience asked Jocelyn, what piece of public art has caused you the biggest headache or required the most maintenance?
Well, for years, it was Art Higgins' piece at Rogers Park, the piece with all the whirligigs that you turn. It's a fantastic piece, and every school after we put this Art Higgins piece in wanted a piece just like it. So that was one of the problems, is that we had to talk every school after that out of wanting one of these pieces. So he put this in, and everything you do with this piece, you turn a crank and all these cool wooden animals turn and go, and it's just and then you twirl something else and this thing spins around and then animals go across it's just a fantastic piece. But it needs daily oiling, it's just high maintenance. And he made a lot of the gears that are in it, so you can't just go to Lowe's or Home Depot and buy replacement parts, because he had, you know, made some of these gears. So finally, we would spend money every couple of years and get it all fixed. And then after a couple of years, things would stop working again. And I finally told the school, I said, you know, I know you love this piece, but this piece is just loved to death. Every time the kids come by, they want to play with it. And so finally I said, I'm going to have to take it out and find another home for it, or just deaccession it if we can't find a way to make it, you know, work. And I said, is there anyone on your staff that would be willing to volunteer to maintain this piece? And they found someone on their staff, and then we connected them up with the King Career Center, the mechanics guy at the King Career Center. So together, the two of them are keeping this piece pretty functioning, which is great. It sort of solved that issue. But that was one of my biggest maintenance issues for a long time. And I can't, you know, most of them Maintenance is a big issue. Some things need little constant maintenance every couple of years, oiling, cleaning, waxing. Other things don't need maintenance until, boom, major meltdown. Then they need painting and fixing and electrical work done. And the other issue we have in Anchorage is a lot of the our buildings are built, and we have a lot of frost heaving, which, you know, if you've got electrical going through that or whatever, sometimes there's just, you know, you have to keep going back and redoing it kind of thing. So that can be an issue.
Last, an audience member asked, what is the process for deaccessioning a piece of art?
When we deaccession a piece, if it's like maybe vandalized, although I have to say, we have very little vandalism in the program. You'd be amazed at how little vandalism we have in the program. I think people inherently do respect artwork. If there's a complaint about the program or a piece, or it becomes a safety issue, like maybe the function of the piece just changes, or the function of the room or the space changes, and all of a sudden the piece is getting more wear and tear or somehow more light and that's damaging it. If there's over 10 years of complaints about a piece in a space, like at Inlet View Elementary School, we had a piece in the library, and it was by Keith Apple, and it was this wonderful sort of drapery piece that was magical, and there was a little chair, and it was supposed to be a storybook room. And the fire marshal said, it's a room. Even though you could walk right through it because it was just these flaps of fabric, he said it's a room, so you can only have 10 students at a time there. And that didn't work for anyone. It didn't work for the librarian or the teacher who was bringing their kids there. So they ended up just storing their TVs and video machines in there, and it ended up being a storage room. So we would go down and we would talk and try and work out a system to make it work again. And they'd empty it out, and it depended too on the principal of the school at the time. But finally, it just got so that it wasn't used for so many years. So, and then the fire marshal made me do a couple of tests on it to make sure it was fire resistant, which at that point, it was no longer, the fabric was no longer fire resistant because that wears off. So we took it down. We donated all the fabric to a junior theater, I think. And then we donated the chair to the Muldoon library, the Muldoon municipal library. But basically, a piece has to go through we feel that a piece should go through at least the kind of process that it was selected through to be deaccessioned through. So it's a pretty lengthy piece. The Public Art Committee has to deaccession it. If it was a piece over a certain amount of money, it has to go to the assembly to be deaccessioned. So it's a pretty, or maybe the piece is stolen. We have had one piece stolen that we've had to deaccession. We've had three pieces stolen that we've actually gotten back that we found again. So that's a good track record. We've only actually lost completely one. So anyway, that's our process, basically. Great. Well, thank you. You've been a great audience.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Jocelyn Young, curator of public art for the municipality of Anchorage. She responded to questions from the audience following her talk on the history of public art in Anchorage and Alaska. The Cook Inlet Historical Society hosted Jocelyn Young at the Anchorage Museum on September 15, 2011. You can find photos of the public art discussed on today's program at alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.